From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Our Soul Music Week continues today with stories about soul classics recorded at Stax Records in Memphis and at the Muscle Shoals studio in Alabama. Steve Cropper remembers producing and backing Otis Redding. Isaac Hayes tells how he co-wrote the song Soul Man. Jerry Wexler talks about producing Aretha Franklin. And Dan Penn talks about writing Do Right Woman. Soul Week continues coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. An explosion in Tokyo has left at least 41 people dead and dozens injured. The blast occurred after midnight in the city's nightclub district and was followed by a fire that quickly spread to nearby buildings. The BBC's Charles Scanlon reports from Tokyo.
The four-story building was packed with customers when the explosion occurred at 1 o'clock in the morning. Fire then swept through the restaurants and other entertainment rooms, forcing some survivors onto the roof. Witnesses said three men fell or jumped into the street below. Police said the explosion occurred when an employee in a third-floor gaming room opened a door. The blast ripped a hole through the outer wall of the building. The cause is not known. Firemen used ladders to rescue people from the building, which quickly filled with thick smoke. There are few windows and only one entrance, making rescue work difficult. Some of the survivors were badly burned.
The BBC's Charles Scanlon in Tokyo. A Republican congressman from Arizona has admitted that he never lived in the precinct where he has voted during his 41 years as an elected official. Bob Stump said that since 1980 he's lived in Phoenix. That's 17 miles from the 80-acre farm in Tolleson that he lists as his voting address. Arizona Elections Director Jessica Funkhauser says she'll look into the matter. Residency is not a requirement for a congressional run, but it is a requirement for voting. A New York Little League team has had to give up its third-place finish in the Little League's World Series and every other game it won this year. That decision comes from the Little League officials in Pennsylvania after the league found that star pitcher Danny Almonte is actually 14 years old and not 12, which is the age limit. The Sioux City man suspected of killing seven people is facing homicide charges. Brian Bull of South Dakota Public Radio reports.
Sioux City Police Chief Joe Frisbee says Adam Moss is now in custody, and formal charges will be filed by a Woodbury County Attorney's Office next week. Frisbee says a murder weapon has been recovered, but did not elaborate on it. He did, however, confirm the victims' names, 31-year-old Letissa Aguilar, her five children, and 58-year-old Ron Fish. Neighbors report that Moss and Aguilar had lived in the same house, but no connection has been tied to Fish, except that the two men knew each other. The bodies of Aguilar and her children were found in their home last night, while Fish was found in the entryway of his house at about the same time. Moss was taken in by police late this morning. For NPR News, I'm Brian Bull in Vermilion, South Dakota.
Both sides are declaring victory in a battle between two discounters. Kmart has taken down its signs comparing the prices in its stores to those of other retailers, including Target. In response, Target has withdrawn its request for a temporary restraining order that would require Kmart to remove the signs. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 30 points to finish at 9,949, and the NASDAQ was up 13 at 1805. This is NPR News. For the first time since 1988, August will come and go without a hurricane forming in the Atlantic Basin. But that doesn't necessarily mean forecasters for a more active-than-usual season are wrong. From member station WJCT in Jacksonville, Kevin Mearshart reports.
Forecasters' latest prediction is for a dozen tropical storms, with eight becoming hurricanes in the Atlantic Basin this year. But so far, only four tropical storms have developed. National Weather Service meteorologist Steve Litro says while the season is starting slow, that doesn't mean it'll stay that way.
If you go back to that year 1988, which was the last time we had this kind of situation, that season eventually produced Hurricane Gilbert, which wound up being a Category 5 hurricane and recorded the lowest central pressure we've ever seen in this hemisphere.
Litro says they expect the season will start to become very active in the next few weeks. A tropical wave off the African coast is expected to develop in the coming days. The season peaks on September 10th. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Mershart in Jacksonville.
Researchers project that more than 2 out of 5 HIV infections in San Francisco by the year 2005 will be drug-resistant. The group estimates the current rate at around 28%. Scientists say that when the virus is exposed to drugs in treatment, it can learn to adapt to the drugs. Therapy demands a complicated regimen that may have severe side effects and is difficult to maintain. The study is in the journal Nature Medicine. John McCain's out of the hospital. The Arizona Republican senator joked with reporters today as he left the Mayo Clinic Hospital in Phoenix 2 days after having surgery for an enlarged prostate. McCain said the operation was routine for what he called an old guy like me. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Laura and Gary Lauder for support of the NPR Endowment, for support of the NPR Fund for New Initiatives, and helping to develop NPR online at www.npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Soul Music Week on Fresh Air. Today we hear from some songwriters, producers, and session musicians who created the soul sound of Stax Records in Memphis and the Muscle Shoals Studio in Alabama. First, Dan Penn, a songwriter and session guitarist, who was one of the key figures behind the scenes in Memphis and Muscle Shoals.
Take me to heart, and I'll always love you. And nobody can make me do wrong. Me for granted.
My guest Dan Penn co-wrote Do Right Woman, as well as I'm Your Puppet, Dark End of the Street, and Cry Like a Baby. Otis Redding, Percy Sledge, Solomon Burke, Arthur Alexander, and Aretha Franklin are among the singers who did his songs. I spoke with Dan Penn in 1994 after he released a CD called Do Right Man, on which he sang his own songs.
Yeah, yeah. They say that it's a man's world. But honey, you can't prove that by me. And as long as we're together, baby, show some respect for me. If you wanna do right, home days, woman, you gotta be a do-right, home, not a man. Woman's only human.
Dan Penn co-wrote that with Chips Moman. They gave Aretha Franklin Do Right Woman when producer Jerry Wexler of Atlantic Records took her to record in Muscle Shoals, Alabama.
Jerry loved it. Aretha heard it. She liked it. But they both said, it doesn't have a bridge. It needs a bridge. And I agreed. So we headed for the closet, three of us, while the band was learning it. And we wrote the bridge, Aretha, Jerry, and I. They say that it's a man's world. All of that.
Now, the way the story, as I've read it, goes about the session in which Aretha recorded your song, Do Right Woman, was that it was a disaster at first.
It wasn't a disaster at first. It was a disaster later, but at first it was a wonderful session. Because they cut I Never Loved a Man, and it came off, well, you know, you heard it came off great.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a wonderful session. Everybody was joyful, and it was great. And then later, when everybody got to drinking a little too much, not me. Not that time. So I was just watching all the haps go down. And there were a few incidents that happened at the studio and then later on at the hotel. I didn't even go to the hotel, so I didn't see the main fight, but I understood about it. But, you know, by the time The second song they cut, they only cut two songs, Never Loved a Man and Do Right Woman. And, I mean, she didn't have time to learn the song. So I had to do the song. I had to do the palate vocal in her key with only a spooner on the organ and a little guitar chink and a drum and a bass hitting every once in a while. It sounded awful when they left Alabama with it. And I had no hopes that that it would ever sound good at all. But later on, Chips and I came to New York, and we were at Atlantic Records, and Wexler, Jerry, said, come back here with me, boys. I'm going to play you something. He took us back to the Atlantic studio, and he played Aretha's. She had gone in and played piano and sang so great, and her sisters. And it was a great moment in our lives, and probably one of the highest places I ever heard, you know, ever felt for me. It was so wonderful.
When you record demos for a performer who's going to do one of your songs, do you try to sing in their style?
No, at one time I might have, but anymore I just try to sing the song some kind of honest way, that the way I feel it. I try to be neutral, kind of. Actually, I try to undersing just a little bit.
Why?
Don't obscure them, you know.
Oh, so that they could feel, well, that's okay, but I'll show you how it really should be done.
Well, now, you know, if it's a black singer, I would do the best I could, because they can always do better. But a lot of white singers, you have to kind of underplay it, because, excuse me, a lot of them can't really sing as good as maybe they could, you know. I mean, you scare them. You hit some notes or some little trills that maybe only you can do at that time, and they love it, and they try to do it, and it don't come off, and then, you know, there goes your song down the drain.
Mm-hmm.
So I give them a neutral, hey, here's a song, do your own thing. I try not to interpret.
Now, you grew up in Vernon, Alabama, which is about 80 miles south of Muscle Shoals. Alabama was very segregated when you were growing up. So what was it like for you when you started working with black artists and becoming part of black culture? Was it all very different to you? Were you ever uncomfortable around black culture? Or did you feel very comfortable right from the start?
I felt comfortable right from the start, and I stayed comfortable right up until, until it was over.
Until what was over? Soul music?
Yeah. You know, I think when they killed Martin Luther King, it was over.
What changed for you when Martin Luther King was killed?
Well, what changed for me was, the black folks didn't want to make records with white people anymore. And so, since I was white, that kind of cut me out. And when we found that out, you know, we basically didn't want to do business either, so it was a bad time.
Were there people who you had been very close with musically who you weren't able to work with anymore?
No, it wasn't like that. It was just like, it was like an invisible line, a curtain was drawn across the color line as far as recording. I mean, it's something you felt, it's something you knew.
In the days before the King assassination, were you ever self-conscious about being a white songwriter in soul music?
Well, you knew you were, but I wasn't alone. I mean, there's Cropper and, you know, all these other cats, Chips and Spooner and you name it. I mean, you know, they were Carole King. I mean, they were all around. But, no, it wasn't a self-conscious thing. It was like, hey, this is wonderful. But it wasn't like I'm not supposed to be here. It was like, oh, how lucky I am.
Right.
And it was fun.
Songwriter Dan Penn is my guest. You worked at studios in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and in Memphis. Was there a difference in the sound at both of those studios?
Yes, it was different. Subtle differences. I always say that it's the air. But I guess it's everything that's there, you know. I mean, I worked in muscle shows at Fame. It had this really great basic sound. And then when I got to Memphis, I could tell a considerably different sound. It was a more exciting sound. I don't know how to say it except, you know, it's a river sound. And it's Memphis is a lower level in altitude. So I always kind of think about altitudes for sounds. Memphis was lower, it was muddier, it was funkier, and it was even more fun. Nashville is higher up, and it's more clean, more pristine, you know, more managed, less fun. Muscle Shoals is right in the middle. It has some of the funky grubby about Memphis in it, but it also has some Nashville cleanness about it. So, you know, any of them sounds good, but Muscle Shoals was the place I chose when I decided to cut the record.
Dan Penn recorded in 1994. Coming up, record producer Jerry Wexler talks about taking Aretha Franklin to record in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, as our Soul Music Week continues. This is Fresh Air. Some of the greatest soul and rhythm and blues recordings wouldn't have been made if it weren't for my guest Jerry Wexler. Wexler was a partner in Atlantic Records from the early 50s through the mid-70s. His specialty was finding great singers and matching them with the right band and backup singers to create a sound that was both artistically true and commercially successful. The short list of people he's worked with includes the Drifters, Ray Charles, Aretha Franklin, Bob Dylan, Wilson Pickett, Otis Redding, Etta James, and Solomon Burke. I spoke with Jerry Wexler in 1993 for a live broadcast from the Public Radio Conference in Washington, D.C. Here's just a few of the records Jerry Wexler produced.
I've been loving you. To stop now. You see the girl with the diamond ring? She knows how to shake that thing. All right, now, now, now. Hey, hey. Hey, hey. I'm gonna wait till the midnight hour. That's when my love.
Great stories about making this music in Jerry Wexler's new memoir. It's called Rhythm and the Blues, and it's just been published by Knopf. Jerry Wexler, welcome to Fresh Air.
It's great to be here to plug my book.
I want to get started with your work with Aretha Franklin. I think that's a good place to start. Now, she had made about, 10 or so recordings on Columbia Records before coming to Atlantic. John Hammond produced her, and he was producing her like a jazz singer, kind of in the Dinah Washington tradition. Yeah. You, when she came to Atlantic, you worked with her. You heard something completely different. What did you hear when you started producing her?
Well, I heard the Aretha Franklin, who sang in church, who sang Precious Lord when she was 13 years old. And a man in the audience was so overcome, he said, listen at her, listen at her. And I listened, and it wasn't so much that I tried a new approach to her. It's that what she did fit very well in with what we were doing anyhow.
Well, you sat her down at the piano. Right. You had her play herself, which I don't think she'd done on the records before that.
Not very much.
You know, what was it like at Muscle Shoals? What did you hear there in that southern sound that you wanted?
Well, it was the way they recorded, which was ad-lib recording without written arrangements, building the song from the get-go, just from the chords, and the musicians made a fabulous contribution. So these were arrangements which we all did together. And they were just as much arrangements as anything that was ever done by Henry Mancini, in the sense of being an arranged piece of music.
So you took Aretha down to Muscle Shoals, recorded like a track and a half with her, and there was this really big fight. What was the fight about?
There was an explosion that went on because of too much Jack Daniels and not enough prudence. And it had to do with Ted White, who was Aretha's husband at the time, who got it into a dangerous, over-friendly drinking from the same jug with a gentleman who can best be described as a card-carrying redneck, trumpet player. And it got into what we called the dozens, the southern dozens, and then it got nasty. And the session blew up, and we went back to New York with one song complete, which was I Never Loved a Man, and a three-piece track on the other side, which was Do Right Woman. And all we had there was rhythm guitar, bass, and drums, which is not a whole lot to go on.
Not even vocal?
No vocal, no piano, no background vocal. And then we finished by bringing Aretha and her sisters into the studio. And it was a pretty good piece of extemporization in that, starting with this very minimal track, Aretha laid down an organ part and a piano part. And then she sang the lead, and then she and her sisters got together and did the background. And it was a very full, finished record put together, I'd say, with spit and chewing gum.
You produced Respect. Is there a story behind how the Sakatumis landed on there?
Well, the story is that when Otis Redding did it, it was entirely a different song. The Sakatumis were Aretha Franklin's idea, where she injected into the song, which connoted a certain idea of social respect, probably the notion of ethnic respect, combined with a little judicious lubricity on her part. The respect that she was talking about was what you might call, very bluntly call, proper sexual attention. But it was her transmutation of Otis Redding's little southern song. As a matter of fact, I was mixing the record in our studio on Broadway, and Otis walked in. He said, "That little gal done took my song."
Now, your first studio was actually the office.
That's right.
Of Atlantic Records. Who did you? Because when Atlantic was young, you didn't have a studio. So what'd you do? You'd move out the chairs into the hallway whenever you wanted to record?
We did have a studio. It was our office, and it was a studio because we had equipment in it. And my partner, Ahmed Erdogan, and I shared this big room. We had two desks that were catty-cornered, canted toward each other. And what we would do is push them against the wall, stack them, and then our engineer, Tom Dowd, would set out camp chairs, a few microphones, and one mic in the hall for echo.
Now, you work with Otis Redding a lot during his career.
I was not Otis's producer. I want you to realize that. Otis was produced at Stax Records in Memphis by that great team of Jim Stewart and Booker T and the MGs, especially Steve Cropper.
Now, you saw him change a lot as he became better
known.
What was he like in the beginning before he was very famous? What was he
Otis
like on stage?
Otis was very simple, very unaffected, but he had the magic. And when he came to New York after his first hit record, I picked him up at the airport. No roadies, nobody, no nothing, just the soul Otis. And he opened at the Apollo, and he just stood there, just straight on, with his arms at his side, didn't move. Another one who started like that was Marvin Gaye. But they learned some stagecraft, but what really kicked Otis into moving was having to follow Sam and Dave, who used to be described as a stage full of Jackie Wilsons.
That's really great. No, you know, we were talking before how you brought Aretha Franklin down to Muscle Shoals, Alabama. You brought Wilson Pickett down to Memphis to record.
Right.
You really loved that southern sound that was coming out of some of the bands there. Why did you think of bringing him there?
Well, because everything was winding down in New York. I mean, it was entropy. We just couldn't get out of our own way. We had been very successful year after year, but our style of recording was a regular old-time standard style, using arrangers with written arrangements. Now, when you have to change an arrangement, and you almost always do, to accommodate the vicissitudes of the song and where you're going, it's total agony for the entrepreneur to see that clock going around while a man is going around with an eraser, erasing little notes on 13 charts. And this southern style of recording, where it's just all you have is chord indications. You go out, you sing a lick, do it like this, fellas. Bang, here's the new chord, you know. But maybe that's overstating it, but actually there's a spontaneity and a fantastic new element that comes in because the musicians are organic to the idea.
Our interview with record producer Jerry Wexler was recorded in 1993 at the annual Public Radio Conference. Our soul music series continues in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Book Magazine, for the passionate reader, featuring books, authors, and articles that read between the lines, in bookstores and online at bookmagazine.com. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Steve Cropper and Isaac Hayes on producing, writing, and performing for Stax Records, the Memphis-based soul label. They're both featured on this track by the label's house band, Booker T and the MGs. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our Soul Music Week continues with Steve Cropper. He was the guitarist on some of the great soul hits of the 60s, records by Carla and Rufus Thomas, Wilson Pickett, Sam and Dave, and Otis Redding.
I've been loving you too long to stop now. Become a habit to me. Ooh, I'm loving you a little too long. I don't want to stop now. Oh. With you, my life.
Otis Redding recorded in 1965 with Steve Cropper on guitar. Cropper also produced some of Otis Redding's recordings. Cropper was a songwriter and producer at Stax Records, the independent record company which helped define the Memphis soul sound of the 60s. Cropper was also the house guitarist. The house band recorded their own records under the name Booker T and the MGs. When I spoke with Cropper in 1990, he said his strength as a guitarist was rhythm.
I never really was a lead player. I never tried to be a lead player. I've been lucky enough to have played a few solos on some great artist records. But really, I'm a rhythm man, and my best forte, I think, is capturing the feel of a song during its inception in the studio. I think that's where I'm best. Even though people fly me in all over to play on their records and overdub, I think they would be better using me on the ground floor, you know, as a building block rather than as a cherry on the cake.
That's interesting, and also that they'd be able to work off of your rhythm while they were
Yeah,
performing.
They don't think of it in those terms because either they don't know me, they just know the aftermath of some of the things I've been lucky enough to be part of. But I don't know if it's a gift or it's because I had such a love for, like I said, spiritual music in the beginning, that I have this talent that just sort of comes with finding the right groove for a song when I'm in the studio with an artist. And that seems to be the thing that always seems to make it, whether we're working with Rod Stewart. You know, I did a lot of stuff with Rod and Tommy Dowd, and I did a lot of the original stuff with Ringo and stuff, you know, when he did his solo albums and all. And those were the songs that seemed to make it up the charts, the ones that I was there on the ground for, helping the rhythm with the drummer and stuff like that.
You had your first hit with a band called The Marquees.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me about who the band was and how you made the record.
Well, originally, Charlie Freeman and I, we started playing guitar with each other, and we just sort of had fun, and he was taking lessons, and he'd go to his lesson, and I'd wait for him at his house for him to get back, and he'd teach me what he learned that day. So I was kind of cheating the system a little bit, but anyway, we just started playing different things. We did some Elvis songs and some rock and roll and stuff like that, and we had a friend who thought that we were good. Obviously, we probably were pretty lousy at the time, but we didn't know that. And he said, "I've got a friend who's a disc jockey. He said, I'd like to take you guys down there and let him hear you, you know, and we're just young guys." So anyway, he took us down to his radio show one night. The guy's name was Keith Sheriff. And we went down there, and he said, "Okay, what do you guys got?" You know, we told him we've got some songs and so forth. He said, "Well, I want to hear you." And so he put us in a studio, the two of us, and opened up a mic. He said, "Now, you know, I'm doing my show now, but," he said, "I can hear you guys." And he said, "You just go ahead and do your thing, you know." So we started playing our stuff, you know, played a couple of songs, and he motioned for us to come in. And about that time, the phone started lighting up, and they were wanting to know, who are those two guys that they just heard? And I'm going, what's this? And he said, well, I didn't tell y'all, but he said, I put you out on the air. So anyway, all these people were calling, wanting to know who we were. And so he told us, he was pretty famous for his sock hops, and he'd have these sock hops every Saturday night at the National Guard Army. And he said, if you guys get a drummer, he said, I'll put you on my sock hop. And so we searched the school and found a guy in the ninth grade who played drums, Terry Johnson. And that was the first band, and we were called the Royal Spades. And shortly after that, we added Duck Dunn on bass, and we got Charlie Axton on saxophone, and Wayne Jackson on trumpet, and Don Nix on baritone, and formed the group The Marquees. And we had written this song with Jerry Lee Smoochie Smith on keyboards, and wrote the instrumental last night. And I think they played it for Atlantic. Atlantic liked it. They pressed up a few copies and put it out on the radio, and lo and behold, it just took off like crazy. So that was our first success.
How old were you when you and the group The Marquees had the hit last night?
When the hit came out, I just graduated. It was the summer we graduated from high school. So I was, 19, 18?
Now, it wasn't long after that you became affiliated with Stax Records. You became the guitarist in the house rhythm section, you became a producer, you became a songwriter with
floor with sweeper.
Stax. Yeah, right.
Tape copier and editor.
How did you get affiliated with Stax?
Well, it started Charles Axton, the tenor player, and the funny story about Charles Axton.
He was the tenor player with the Marquees?
He was a tenor player with the Marquees. He was on the record last night and everything. He came to me and he said, I hear you guys got a pretty good band. He said, I play saxophone. I'd like to be in your band. And I said, well, I'm not really interested. I don't think we're interested in adding horns to the group. And I said, how long have you been playing? You know, and he said, oh, I've been taking lessons for 3 months. And I'm going, oh, yeah, great, you know. And somewhere in the conversation, he goes, oh, by the way, my mother owns a recording studio. And I said, can you show up for rehearsal on Saturday? And that is a true story. Now, I may stretch it a little bit, but that's an actual truth. And we went out. His uncle, Jim Stewart, the owner of Stax Records, had a little studio in his garage in Memphis, and we went out there and jammed around. And then they moved from his garage to a little place out in Brunswick, Tennessee, where they had the Satellite label. And we would go out there every weekend and play and all that. And, of course, Jim Stewart said that we never had a chance, we'd never make it. But I think he just was being devil's advocate to just see if he could push us into something. And we kept trying. We cut a bunch of instrumentals, some crazy little things that never saw the light of day. And until the time that we came up with last night. But what happened was Estelle Axton, I don't know if she saw any talent there or what she saw, but she liked me enough to keep me around, and she put me to work in her record shop. And I sold records. That's what I did. And I kept working on the weekends. I would kind of do a little A&Ring because people were always coming in. And on Saturdays, I would hold auditions because people were always bringing in songs and all that. And that's sort of how I got started, you know, in the A&R thing. And finally, Jim said, wait a minute. He said, Steve's spending more time in the studio and he is in the record shop and whatever. And so they got together and decided that I would be start getting my salary from the record company rather than the record shop. And I started working, I guess, A&R full-time at that point.
Well, you, with the group Booker T and the MGs, had the hit of Green Onions, and I think this was it's a big hit, and it helped out Stax Records a lot. How did the four of you, Booker T, Al Jackson, Donald Duck Dunn, and yourself get to play together and become the house rhythm section?
Well, what it all stemmed from basically was there we were with all this great success doing the Dick Clark Show and everything as the Marquees, and we had this big hit record last night, and it was a lot of fun. And then all of a sudden it wasn't fun anymore. It became work and what you call a road burdened and that sort of thing, and seven of us or eight of us traveling in one car and trying to make all these shows. And I found out that I wasn't too happy with the road. And so what I really wanted to do was get back in the studio. I mean, I'd already knew that that's what I wanted to do. Anyway, that's what I did. I came back to Memphis. I went to work in the studio again. I helped put together the rhythm section. I found out I'd been playing with another band called the Club Handy Band, and we had done some sessions for Don Robey. I don't even remember which songs, but I played on the Five Blind Boys albums. I played on Al T&T Bragg's. I think there was some Bobby Blue Bland stuff that I played on. But I played with a lot of those musicians, and we were asking around to find out who was a real good keyboard player. We had used several, and they said, there's this kid, he's still in school, named Booker T. Jones, and he's incredible. And they had worked with him on a lot of other stuff and on stage as well. And so we got Booker over on a session, and everybody just fell in love with him.
Let me play some of Green Onions, and because we're only going to play an excerpt, I'm going to start this a little in because I want to get to your guitar solo in it. So this is Green Onions, Booker T. and the MGs. We'll hear more of our interview with Steve Cropper after a break. This is Fresh Air. It's Soul Music Week on Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1990 interview with Steve Cropper. We're talking about his work in the 60s as a songwriter, producer, and session guitarist for Stax Records, the Memphis-based soul label. I want to ask you about some of the now classic records that you played on. Some of these are songs that you co-wrote. You co-wrote Dock of the Bay with Otis Redding, and you produced the record as well, right?
Right, correct.
What was your collaboration with him like when it came to writing songs?
Well, of course, we wrote a lot of songs together. The inception of Dock at the Bay was really no different than any other one. Otis was one of those kind of guys who had 100 ideas, and he always had with him, anytime he came in to record, 10 or 15 different pretty good ideas, either intros or titles or whatever. And he had been in San Francisco doing the Fillmore. And the story that I got, he had rented a boathouse or stayed out at a boathouse or something. That's when he got the idea of watching the ships come in the bay there. And that's about all he had. I watched the ships come in, watch them roll away again, and I'm sitting on the dock of the bay. And I just took that. We just sat down, and I just kind of learned the changes that he was kind of running over. And I finished the lyrics. And if you listen to songs that I collaborated with Otis, most of the lyrics are about him. Well, he never really... He might say the big O in a song or something like that, but Otis didn't really write about himself, but I did. Songs like Mr. Pitiful, Sad Song, Fa-Fa, they were all about Otis and Otis's life, and Dock of the Bay is exactly that. I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay. It was all about him going out to San Francisco to perform, and that's kind of the way I wrote with Otis. I wrote the bridge and stuff like that, and that's the way we collaborated. He trusted me. I always seemed to do the things that he liked, worked on songs that came out the way he wanted them. And I also worked on a lot of songs with Otis, arrangement-wise, and helped him put them together and all that, where I didn't, claim any writers or anything, because it wasn't necessary. Otis had most of it finished to begin with, and I just helped him do it. But a lot of these things where he had just bits and pieces, I would actually put them together, and we'd make whole songs out of them and go in the next day and record them. So we had a lot of fun together. Otis was a great guy to work with, and he was a great friend.
Well, let's listen to the record. This is Dock of the Bay.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ships roll in,
Then I watch them roll away again. Yeah, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, I'm just sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay. I've had nothing to live for, and look like nothing's gonna come my way. So I'm just gonna sit on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. Look like nothing's gonna change. Everything still remains the same. I can't do what 10 people tell me to do, so I guess I'll remain the same. Listen, sitting here resting my bones, and this loneliness won't leave me alone. Listen, 2,000 miles I roam, just to make this dock my home. Now I'm just gonna sit at the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time.
Dock of the Bay, recorded by Otis Redding in 1967. Redding co-wrote the song with Steve Cropper. Cropper told me it was his idea to mix in the sound of the waves.
Atlantic said they were a little too loud, but I stuck in there. I kept them in. I thought the birds in the ocean was great.
I want to ask you about another record. And this is also a song you co-wrote. You co-wrote this one with Wilson Pickett, and it's Midnight Hour.
Uh-huh.
This was, I think, for the first session that you played with Wilson Pickett.
Right, it was.
Tell me about writing the song with him.
Well, it's real simple. We knew that he was coming down, and, of course, my connection with the record shop. And I went up and found some stuff that he had sung on. Of course, he sang, you know, with the Falcons, and he had sang some spiritual things. And it seemed like every time that he sang lead on something, when he got down to the fade-out, he would go, oh, wait till the midnight hour. Whoa, see my Jesus in the midnight hour. And all this, I said, that's the guy's ID. So I just took that right there and presented it to him with a little idea. He had a couple of ideas, and what happened was that we picked him up at the airport. They dropped us off at the hotel, and Jerry Wexler and Jim Stewart went out to get something to eat and just talk business. And when they came back, I don't know, it was a couple hours later, we had In the Midnight Hour written, and Don't Fight It. They said, we're going to get out of here, let you guys keep going. And they left, and we wrote a thing called I'm Not Tired. And we went in the studio the next day, recorded all three songs, and all three songs were hits. Very lucky me, huh?
Well, let's hear In the Midnight Hour.
I'm gonna wait till the midnight hour. That's when my love comes tumbling down. I'm gonna wait till the midnight hour, when there's no one else around. I'm gonna take you, girl, and hold you, and do all the things I told you. Yes, I am. Oh, yes, I am.
Our interview with Steve Cropper was recorded in 1990. Coming up, Isaac Hayes talks about his work with the Memphis-based soul label Stax Records. This is Fresh Air. We conclude today's edition of Soul Music Week with Isaac Hayes. He's famous for his classic recordings like Shaft and Hot Buttered Soul. He's also known now for his role on the animated TV series South Park as the voice of Chef. Hayes was an important behind-the-scenes figure in the 60s at the Memphis-based soul music label Stax Records, where he worked as a producer, songwriter, and arranger, as well as singer. He co-wrote hits for Sam and Dave, Carla Thomas, and Johnny Taylor. In 1994, I spoke with Isaac Hayes about his work at Stax Records. Now, I know before you started making your own records, before you started singing in your records, you produced for other people, and also you played piano and keyboards. Mm-hmm. You used to play with Booker T and the MGs. Now, how did you learn to play piano? Growing up as poor as you did, I know there were times in your life when you didn't have shoes, let alone a piano.
That's true. How did I do that? Well, let's see. A friend of mine I grew up with, Sidney Kirk, used to be my accompanist. We went places and he'd play for me. He joined the Air Force. He wasn't there. There was a call into him about a gig New Year's Eve. His sister knew that I was destitute and I needed money, so she asked me if I wanted to play. Well, I could play maybe chopsticks and stuff like that. And I said, yeah, I'll take it. I took the gig out of desperation. And when I got to the club, I was petrified. I said, oh, my God, they're going to shoot me. I can't play. And musicians started coming in, you know, setting up, tuning up, and I'm sitting there, you know, trying to be cool. I said, God, they're going to find me out. And the featured artist came in and said, hey, man, do y'all know such and such? This is the first time this band had been put together. We didn't rehearse anything. And everybody said, yeah, we know it, blah, blah, blah. So he kicked off the tune, and it sounded horrible. Everybody did. I said, wow, these guys can't play either, so I'm comfortable. And, you know, being New Year's Eve, the clientele was drunk, and they thought we were cooking, you know. So, and somewhere along the line, the club owner, he was sauced. He came up and said, you know, you boys sound real good. Y'all want a regular job? Yeah, we'll take it. And that was in Memphis, and it was a regular gig, and each night I would learn something more and more on keyboards. And that's how I got started.
That's great. And then you started sitting in with Booker T and the MGs.
Well, I wound up at Stax Records. I changed bands, and I joined Floyd Newman's band, who was a staff musician at Stax. He played baritone saxophone. All those bot-ups and stuff like that, that was Floyd. So he was up for recording. He said, man, you know, we're going in the studio. Now, I had been to Stax about three different times with the blues band, with a vocal group, you know, trying to get a break, and it was always turned down.
Mm-hmm.
This time I went in with Floyd and Howard Grimes, the drummer. He and I wrote some songs, some instrumentals and things like that. And Jim Stewart, who, you know, was co-owner of Stax, he said, you know, you sound pretty good on keyboards. Booker T is off in Indiana U in school. Would you like to become a staff musician here? Yeah, you know. So that's how I got in Stax. And my first session, I think, was an Otis Redding album session. I was scared to death. But he made it easy. And I learned a lot, and I fit right in. And I became a staff musician. So when Booker came back, he and I both played on sessions. We would switch around. Sometimes I'd play organ, and he'd play piano, and sometimes I'd play piano, he'd play organ. And with Duck, Steve, and Al, we were the nucleus of Stax, the rhythm section, and then, of course, the horns and so forth.
Now, you were not only a house musician at Stax, you became a house songwriter, and you wrote a lot of songs with your partner then, David Porter. And some of the most famous songs that you wrote were for Sam and Dave, like Soul Man and Hold On, I'm Coming. How were you given them to write for?
Well, first thing, David, when I started at Stax on staff, David and I went to rival schools, sang in rival groups. And he said, hey, man, I write lyrics and you play music. Let's hook up and write like Holland Doja Holland. I said, okay. So we teamed up and we started writing. And one day, Jim Stewart called us all, everybody on staff, said, we got some fellas coming down and they need some writers and producers. So they're going to come around and meet with everybody and you show them what you got. So when Sam and Dave and them came to town, they, you know, met with everybody, and they wanted to work with David and me. And that's how the whole thing started.
What do you remember about writing Soul Man?
Well, I remember getting the idea from watching TV and the riots in Detroit. And it was said that if you put soul on your door, your business establishment, they would bypass it and wouldn't burn it. And then the word soul, you know, the clenched fist, you know, soul brother, soul this. It was a galvanizing kind of thing as far as, you know, African Americans were concerned. And it had that kind of effect of unity. And they said it with a lot of pride. So I said, well, why not write a tune called Soul Man? And all you had to do was write about your own personal experiences. Because, you know, all African Americans in this country, during those times especially, had similar experiences. So we did that, but realized that it, in addition to being an African American experience, it was a human experience. So therefore, it crossed the board. And then the groove and all everything else that went with it just made it, you know, very, very commercial.
So did you arrange this too?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And are you featured instrumentally?
I wasn't featured. I just played piano on it. Well, you know, I did some little hot mixing and stuff like that.
So okay. Well, let's hear Soul Man, co-written by my guest, Isaac Hayes. Our interview with Isaac Hayes was recorded in 1994. Fresh Air's Soul Music Week isn't over yet. We'll bring you the final edition on Labor Day. Fresh Air's executive producer is Denny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shirock, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Lauren Krenzel. Sue Spolin directed today's show. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Lost Soldiers, a novel set in present-day Vietnam by James Webb, author of Fields of Fire. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, our soul music series concludes with the Motown sound. We'll hear from Motown's founder, Berry Gordy, and three Motown singers, Gladys Knight, Martha Reeves, and Otis Williams of the Temptations. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air. No,